Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
People say I'm crazy. From ruin.
30 years ago today, John Lennon was shot and killed by a deranged fan on the street in New York City. He was the acerbic wit of the Beatles, and much more than that. He pressed the boundaries of an artist's capacity to tinker with the assumptions of a culture. This hour on Point, we're thinking again about John Lennon and the possibility of change through art, through music. You can join the conversation. Was he your Beatle? And what more than that was he to you? What would John Lennon be singing now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Alan Light, contributing writer for Rolling Stone. 3 days before he was gunned down, Lennon told Rolling Stone his critics were only interested in dead heroes. The magazine's latest edition offers, for the first time, the full text of that last interview. We'll hear some of it in this hour, during this show. Alan Light, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And joining us from the BBC studios in London is the celebrated music journalist Keith Badman. He's written a number of books about the Beatles, including Beatles Off the Record and Beatles After the Breakup. Keith Badman, thank you for joining us from across the pond.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And remind us of that album right there, Double Fantasy, finished, just weeks before John Lennon's death. He had been sort of off stage for some years before that came out, Keith.
He has. He went into what he called his retirement in 1975. He'd done something on Ringo's album in 76. And then, as he said, he'd become a house husband. And he just enjoys spending time bringing up Sean and baking bread, as he said. And then, of course, 1980 was his big decide to come back. And Double Fantasy was to be that album.
Double Fantasy came out, and with that, he was coming back out kind of into the public eye. And his interview, Alan, with Rolling Stone was a big part of that. A little bit of it was published just after his death, but a whole lot more now. Remind us who it was talking with John Lennon, where they were, what were the circumstances?
Well, this last interview was done with Jonathan Cott, who was not only an original Rolling Stone staffer, but actually did the interview with John that ran in the very first issue of Rolling Stone. And he did this interview a couple of days, you know, before John was murdered. And then all of the coverage was about what had happened and all these tributes to John. And so this interview, Jonathan said that he'd actually never even gone back and transcribed the whole thing. And this is the first time that it's seeing light of day. You know, John was back in work mode. He was doing interviews again. He was seeing the press again, making those kinds of appearances, and seemingly in a place where he was, you know, he was at peace. He felt like he was doing this because he wanted to. He was ready to, and so was opening himself up in these conversations in a different way than he had before.
He always knew how to make a splash. He had just posed on the day of his shooting for the famous photograph where he's naked and kind of wrapped around, almost fetal style, Yoko Ono there at the Dakota in New York. The tape from this interview in Rolling Stone is out as well, and we have some of it. We'll play in this hour. Here's John Lennon. Rolling Stone's Jonathan Cott had asked him about the messages in his music.
You know, give peace a chance, not shoot people for peace. All you need is love. I believe it. It's damn hard, you know, but I absolutely believe it. I'm not claiming divinity. I've never claimed divinity. I've never claimed purity of soul. I've never claimed to have the answer to the life. I have never made any claims. I only put out songs and answer questions as honestly as I can, but only as honestly as I can.
John Lennon, in the Rolling Stone interview 3 days before his death, in 1980. Keith Badman, how does that sound now with these all these decades, 3 decades since then? I never claimed divinity. I never made any claims. I just wrote songs. Is that how the UK looks at John Lennon now?
I think they do. He's very missed, there's no doubt about it. Mm. And sometimes we really do want someone like him around now. That's my opinion, because there was no BS, if you know what I mean. There was nothing pretentious. I know P.E. did get attacked for that back in the 60s and 70s, whatever. But I think in the UK, he was very forthright. And when he was coming back in 1980, there was a massive load of excitement. But the funny thing was, when the album Double Fantasy came out, many of the new music critics didn't like it. It was panned. That's the fact. But the thing is, we all missed him. You know, we still miss him now, because like in that interview now, which I thought was fabulous, it was just telling it like it was, telling it like it is. And that, I think, is missing, especially nowadays. There's a hell of a lot of pretense. But John was never like that. And that's why I love him so much. And that's why we still miss him. Because the fact, he was an interesting person.
No kidding.
That's my point. I think he was just honest, and I think that's what we loved about him.
Of course, he was had just turned 40 when he died. Would have been 70 this year. But there was a kind of maturity, Alan, in this interview with Jonathan Cott. I'll play a little more of the tape from the Rolling Stone interview right here. First time the whole thing has been out in public. And he's really talking about the kind of self-awareness that comes with maturity. Here's John Lennon, 1980, 3 days before his death.
The hardest thing is facing yourself. It's easier to shout revolution and power to the people than it is to look at yourself and try and find out what's real inside you and what isn't. When you pull the wool over your own eyes, your own hypocrisy. That's the hardest one. And that's what I'm involved in.
That's what I'm involved in. 3 days later, he was dead. Alan, how do you read the man who comes through in this big, long, last interview with Jonathan Cott?
Well, I think what's so striking, thinking about John right at the end, you know, in these last few weeks of his life, is he had taken the time away from making music. He had finally found, I think, a kind of peace with himself by finally having the family experience that he'd never had, that he didn't have growing up, that he hadn't had with his first son and his first wife in the midst of all the Beatles madness. Mm-hmm. And I think that he was making music again with a much clearer sense of why he was doing it. As you hear in these clips, there was an awareness and a maturity. And as Keith said, there was always, John was always about honesty and about directness and about saying what was on his mind. But there's a sense of self-reflection that comes through, and I think that's what came through on the album. And as Keith said, it's absolutely right. The album was not universally well accepted when Double Fantasy came out. A lot of people said, you know, we waited 5 years for our rebel hero, and he came back, you know, singing songs about taking care of his kid and being at home and having this domestic life. I spoke recently to Jack Douglas, who produced Double Fantasy, and he said that whenever John heard those criticisms of the album as it was coming out, he took it as a great victory. He was really proud, even if people didn't like that was what was coming through. That was what he was intending. That was exactly what he wanted that record to be. That those are the kinds of songs he wanted to write. You know, he was 40 years old at that time. The world wasn't used to grown-up rock stars. Now we have 60, 70-year-old touring bands. But back then, 40, you know, what did you do if you were 40 and you were a rock star? And he wanted to look very clearly at that and think about, how do you mature as an artist? What do you do with your audience and that opportunity?
It was a long way from the sort of glam, screaming zillions of the early days in the UK and the US, and certainly even from 1970, his first post-Beatles album, John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band. We'll play a little bit of Working Class Hero here, kind of an angry critique of what capitalist society can do to people.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
John Lennon, 1970, a decade before his death, his first album out of the Beatles. Alan Light with Rolling Stone is with us. Keith Badman's here from London. And you can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Osaka, Japan. Lawrence, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, I'm a long-time listener on by podcast usually.
Wonderful. What are you thinking in Osaka, Japan, Lawrence?
Well, first, I wanted to mention to both Alan and Keith and see what they have to say about the difference between the kind of myth and legend that's built up around John Lennon and the man himself. Lennon NYC, the new documentary on PBS, we can't actually get it in Japan. But I've heard the interviews for it with everybody who was part of John's life in the New York years, and you really get to know that he was very different from the way people often portray him.
Hey, Lawrence, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break. We'll come back to you. If you'll hang on in Japan, we're talking about John Lennon on the 30th anniversary of his death. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Join us, 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about John Lennon on the 30th anniversary of his death, looking at Lennon, the Beatles, his life, his legacy, and the possibility of change through art, through music. Nowhere Man there, 1965, the Beatles' Rubber Soul. And you can hear Lennon's kind of moody, introspective songwriting right there. Alan Light is with us from Rolling Stone. They've got a big interview out, done just 3 days before John Lennon's death in December 1980. Joins us from New York and from London. Keith Badman is here, big musical journalist figure in the UK, author of, book after book on the Beatles. You can join us as well. Were you around? Do you remember what John Lennon meant then? Do you remember getting the news the day he died and what it meant? And what's the lasting meaning, message of John Lennon? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And we've got a caller from Osaka, Japan, Lawrence, who we got caught in the break on the line, Lawrence, and I had to jump in just when you were getting going there. Take us to your point, Lawrence.
Well, I'm still with you. I'll
Great.
Be quick. Yeah, he's often painted as a saint, and I think Lennon himself and the people around him would say he's more of a truth teller than a saint. And on the other extreme, people who don't really understand John think of him as sort of snide and sarcastic. But he was, I think he would say, and people around him would say, that he was insecure, basically. And the last thing I wanted to mention was, that he's often, well, actually, I'd like to cut it short.
Well, that's pretty good right there. You've got a lot on the table for us, Lawrence. Enjoy Osaka, and thanks for your call. Keith Badman, how about it? Snide and sarcastic, insecure, but all three?
I think
clearly
there's
more than that.
There's chance that if we were to sit and analyse John Lennon, I think you'll find we could have like 100 different opinions of him. I think his honesty, we all remember his famous The Beat Was Bigger Than Jesus Christ from 1966. All remember that.
Yeah.
He made it in 65, of course, become public 66. He was just basically saying what he thought to a close friend about the Beatles, how they stood in the world at that time. He was just being honest. And that's what we're coming back to. He was very honest, but he also, I do believe, he was very insecure. But as many people are, there are many people who are insecure, but they don't let it show. John tended to let it show. You know, that's my opinion, but I'm sure other people have different opinions of their own.
And he would usually come back and talk about what was... Yes, Alan, sorry, Alan.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that, you know, the caller's point is a good one. I think that John certainly has been kind of shrouded in this, you know, this saint-like, you know, pacifist. There's a sort of a fixed view of what John was. And clearly, like many artists, John was a wildly complicated figure.
Yeah.
You know, John could... There was that, he said, snideness, that brashness and arrogance about the way that he presented himself. John also couldn't stand the sound of his own singing voice. And was always begging his producers to put more echo and treatment and just find anything to make it sound different than what it sounded. And I think that that collision between his, you know, his artistic confidence and brashness with this, you know, this edge of vulnerability in everything that he did, I think that, you know, that complexity is such an important part of what he was as an artist. I think all of those things, they're all going on all the time.
And the huge danger 30 years on of being turned into a kind of T-shirt icon, that sunglass Lennon in the New York T-shirt and, you know, other images that can reduce and reduce and reduce what, as you say, was a very complex guy. There was, of course, the famous quip to a British journalist about the Beatles being bigger than Jesus. He later talked about exactly what was going on in that statement. Here's a little bit of that courtesy of Independent Television News in England.
When I was talking about it, it was very close and intimate with this person I know who happens to be a reporter. And I was using expressions on things that I just read and derived from about Christianity. Only I was saying it in the simplest form that I know, which is the natural way I talk. And I just said it in those things that were more popular than Jesus and so on and so on and so and so. But she took them, and people that know me took them exactly as it was, because they know that's how I talk.
That's how I talk. It got a lot of attention.
There you go.
To our callers, Joe in Stowe, Vermont. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I worked in the Russian Tea Room in the early 1970s in New York City.
Yeah.
And this was a period when John was clearly family man, and he would come in the Russian Tea Room. And one time in particular, he came in with Yoko. It was probably 1974 or so.
Okay. Yeah.
And John, Yoko, and Sean, and they had a friend with them. But John had Sean in like a baby Bjorn on the front, like a baby pack.
Yeah, a snuggie
kind
of thing.
All the weight people came around and were just hovering and just really reveling in this iconic man who had obviously become this incredibly dedicated father. And I just wanted to, this today means a lot to me because of, I flash back to that, and that's the John Lennon that I really like to remember.
I mean, it's a long way, though, from, what, the Beatles coming into the United States for the first time and all the girls screaming at the airport, and here he was with the baby in the pack on his chest, I guess, Joe.
Yes, yep, absolutely. And he was very quiet, and Yoko did most of the talking, and she was great and chatty, and I remember making blinis for them, red caviar blinis, so that meant I had to be at the table, and I had to prepare this whole thing and pour butter on it and do the whole presentation, and he was just, it was just such an honor for me to be there and to actually meet him, and to do that, and to remember now, and when he was killed, and I think it was Howard Cosell who made the announcement on Monday Night Football. It was just horribly devastating.
Joe, you know, that is a gift for you to take us back to the Russian Tea Room and John and Yoko and the baby and you pouring warm butter on the red caviar blinis. That is just fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing that, Joe.
And Tom, I just want to, I think it's an interesting piece of the history that she brings up. I think that when John thinks about what he would have thought about his legacy, in some ways, as much as the peace activism, as much as what he did with the music, he really did create a different model for fathering and for the family unit.
What do you mean
for
by that?
For a lot of people, I don't think that in the 1970s, the notion of the stay-at-home dad who was as involved with raising his kid, who put his own career on hold. I mean, these are things that now are part of, you know, what society looks like, but I think that was much less the case back then, and I think that it's interesting to think about what the impact of a generation that grew up seeing one of their idols take that on as the central part of his life for a while. I think that's a really important part of his story that doesn't get thought about that
much. It's interesting because at his age, he was just ahead of the crest of the boomers. And so, you know, he was born in 1940, not boomer after the war. And so he was doing that as his fans were sort of beginning to think about doing something, maybe just beginning to imagine themselves, you know, not John Lennon on stage with a guitar, but parents with babies. You know, Alan, you've pointed to a song from the John Lennon Plastic Ono Band, God, as a really pivotal piece of evidence of a turning point in his career. I want to play just a little of that and get your thoughts. Here's God from the 1970 album. Don't believe in God there. And the lyrics go on. The dream is over. They say, I don't believe in Beatles. I just believe in me. Alan, put it together with the rest of the picture of John Lennon we're seeing 30 years later.
Well, it's hard to, you know, overestimate the significance and the impact of that song and that album. This was the album that he made, you know, immediately following the breakup mm-hmm. of the Beatles, while that was still being fought over. His first real solo album. He'd done a couple of projects with Yoko before that. And he was going through primal scream therapy at the time. And the idea was to bring all of his emotions and all of his childhood memories and everything to the surface. And the pinnacle of this album is this song where he ends up, you know, it builds and builds to, I don't believe in Beatles. I just believe in me. The dream is over. And it was this really, you know, this shattering of the myth of the you know, this band, all of these other myths, historical, you know, he goes through, I don't believe in Elvis, I don't believe in Kings, I don't believe in, you know, that all you're left with at the, you know, at the end of all of this is yourself.
Is that yet another equation? I mean, the song's called God. Is it another equation of Beatles with, you know, near divinity?
Well, I think it's a, you know, I don't think it was an equation of, mm-hmm. I think it was, you know, it was in some ways, you know, a different articulation of that, where, you know, earlier he had said that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus, you know, and he mm-hmm. made a point of saying, you know, I didn't say they were better. Mm-hmm. I said that they were a bigger, you know, they had more yeah. impact right now. And you know, certainly there's many ways you can make the case that that's true. I think a few years later, it was a sense of, you know, the only thing that matters is, you know, all of this is, all the rest of it is ephemeral. And, you know, Keith was saying before, the honesty in John's writing, the way that he wrote about, I mean, we've heard songs through the breaks here, the mm-hmm. Ballad of John and Yoko and mm-hmm. Nowhere Man. Mm-hmm. He was writing about himself, his family. He wrote the song Julia about his mother. Mm-hmm. People look, you know, they talk about the sort of confessional singer-songwriters and James Taylor and Jackson Browne and those guys in the 70s who started writing these personal, these things about themselves and their lives. Well, that was what John did before anybody was doing it, using his own life, his own personal, you know, experiences
yes,
and thoughts and ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
That was always the basis for his work. From when he was, you know, 24 years old, he was writing songs that were introspective and nostalgic and you know, that set a path for so much of where pop music has gone.
We've got so many callers here, and one coming for you, Keith. But first, let's take it to India. Richard in Providence, Rhode Island. Richard, you're on the air. What's your story?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks so much for your show. I was at the ashram in Rishikesh when the Beatles were there in spring of 68. And the ashram...
This is along the Ganges in India.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Just above the Ganges. And at that point, the Ganges is a very fast rushing river. And after about a month or so at the course, it began to get so hot that a bunch of us would go down there to swim. And more and more people went down there, including the Beatles and the women that were with them. And we were having a great time taking breaks from meditation and swimming. And when the Maharishi heard about all about that we were all going down there to swim. He was horrified because he was afraid people would drown, as you can there. Especially he was worried that Mia Farrow and other celebrities would drown.
Yeah.
So he asked everybody, he pleaded with everybody not to go down there. But everybody kept going down there anyway, including the Beatles. And so that afternoon, we would get together for tea at a table overlooking the valley and the Ganges, and the Beatles would be sitting there, especially, well, you know, John and Paul, and making up songs. And the song they made up that afternoon was, I should tell you first, Maharishi said that we were all swamis. A swami is somebody who's becoming a teacher of yoga.
Yeah.
So all of the course participants, 60 or so of us, were all swamis. So at one point, Paul and John got up with their guitars and sang, Maha don't allow no swamis swimming in here. Maha don't allow no swamis swimming in here. I don't care what Maha don't allow. Swami gonna swim here anyhow.
They were having fun on the banks of the Ganges. Richard, that's a gift as well, taking us there. I appreciate that story so much. One more. Thank you, Richard. One more. New Bedford, Massachusetts. Bob, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm a good friend of Keith Badman. Hello, Keith. Hope you're doing okay.
Oh, good.
Hi, Bob. Good to hear from you.
I'll tell you, involving John Lennon, Keith, and myself. About 2 years ago, Keith came over to the States for the first time doing research on a book he's going to be coming out with on Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
And on a stormy evening, it was very bad weather in October 2008, we took a walk by the Dakota, and it was a very emotional moment.
Where John and Yoko lived, outside of which he was killed. No kidding. It's such a symbol of that now.
Yeah, and I mean, my point is that every day that must happen, where someone just finds it hard when they go by there, and it's just so sad 30 years later.
Yeah, just to see the spires of that building, and they just, you know, you're in Central Park, you look over, there it is, Keith. I mean, you visited now from London, but for Americans, I remember when we first got the news, I'd been living outside the country for a while, was still outside the country, but it just gave me this horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. I mean, in my country, John Lennon would be killed. It was more madness.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. That's how England looked upon it at the time. You know, such a sad way to end to a guy who preached peace, as we know, and he dies at the hand of a crazed gunman. It just was madness. And to be honest with you, we still shake our heads with it now, 30 years on. And it's such a sad way, and I'll keep on saying it's such a senseless, horrible way to die for a guy who preach peace. I agree.
Alan, you know, I mean, the United States had seen John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, but this was something different. This was an artist gunned down.
Well, yes, and with, you know, I think what was so difficult then and now, you know, with the political assassinations, you know, the conspiracies remain. There are always so many questions around it. What was, you know, what those assassinations were about? This was, you saw the answer right in front of you, and then that didn't make it any, you know, didn't make it any clearer or any better to say, well, it's this, you know, it's this one lunatic, and this is what happens. It was impossible to process. What is it that there was no way to answer? What had John done that would deserve this, it would make any sense? I mean, it will never make any sense. And the pain that we all felt then, it doesn't really recede. There's not going to be an answer for that.
And yet he was a kind of representative of a new magnitude of celebrity, almost, that maybe in the twisted mind of his killer, you know, was part of this. We'll come back and look at that. Alan Light, please stand by with Rolling Stone and Keith Badman. In London, this powerful artist killed 30 years ago today, John Lennon, on the streets in New York City. Listeners, you can join us. What did you make of his Yoko years, the naked interviews in bed? Did you stick with him? Do you still? How does Lennon look now, all these years later? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK on the 30th anniversary of the killing of John Lennon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
All we are saved is guilty subject. All we are saved. So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and you won't just be gone.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about John Lennon on the 30th anniversary of his death, looking at Lennon and the Beatles, his life, his legacy, the possibility of change through art, through music. You can join us. Has John Lennon been turned into a T-shirt icon? Does he still have edge? Does he still have meaning for you in your life? 800-423-8255. Alan Light is with us from Rolling Stone. They're out with a big full version of the last big interview done with John Lennon just 3 days before his death. And Keith Badman joins us from the BBC studios in London, has written in great depth about the Beatles. Lots of comments from our listeners here. David saying he was only 3 years old the day John Lennon was killed. He says, but he can still remember sensing an air of stillness. The feeling reminded, David writes, it reminded me of Christmas, he says. Christmas morning, everything seemed to pause. Chris says his message of compassion over fear is what he remembers. He says it hasn't been forgotten, but at times I feel it's being ignored. And Liz writes, I remember a new phase every few years. Maharishi, drugs, macrobiotic diet, peace advocate, primal scream, New York City recluse. I remember that he got religion with his second wife and son after more or less abandoning his first family. She remembers an effortless songwriter that was at his best in the yin-yang of the Lennon-McCartney partnership. Let's take a call from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment, like, from a musician's perspective on this, as far as what he would be doing today, I think he would be very disappointed in modern music and what has become of it, and he would be more than like railing against commercialism and the music industry and the corporate society as we know it. And he'd probably continue making music that communicates with the middle class, which is where he came from. Yeah. And he would be promoting universal harmony in the world. I don't think he would be getting back with the Beatles anytime soon for a tour, because I think they're just in it for more money. I think he would be bitter to that idea. I think he was able to see the forest instead of the trees. I'll take some comments. Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Michael, we thank you. Thank you so much for calling. Let's listen to the man himself, and I'll take it to Alan Light and Keith Badman. There was an appearance on the Dick Cavett Show in 1975, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and there was questions, answers, Q&A with the audience. And one of the audience members asked John Lennon about his support of revolution, and he came into this issue of the artist's role in culture and in change, and talking here about some subtlety in that.
I don't believe in violent revolution. Yoko stated it very well, which is violent revolutionaries are playing the same establishment game. I believe in some of the things Jerry Rubin and A.B. Hoffman have done, like the theatre in court kind of revolution. I believe in the revolution of happening, and that artists, Yoko says artists don't create. A woman, any woman can create, a man can destroy with a Coke bottle, and an artist revalues. If I'm a revolutionary, or we are revolutionaries, we're revolutionary artists, not gunmen. So I'm still for peace, peaceful revolutionary. But I'm an artist first, and a politician second. But if you want to really change the thing, do it subtly in a way that the establishment can't attack, i.e. theatre in court, and or bed events, to virgins, things like that. Things that the establishment don't understand, therefore they can't kill it.
Bed events, things the establishment can't understand. John Lennon in 1975 there. Alan, you hear our caller, who was terrific, but saying he can imagine John Lennon railing today against corporate culture. Maybe. But then you hear him saying there, an artist revalues, do it subtly in a way the establishment can't attack.
Well, I think it's very hard to know exactly, obviously it's all speculative,
sure,
but where John would feel about where music has gone. I've always thought that, I think John would have loved hip-hop. I think John would have loved...
Why exactly?
The explosion of rap and hearing people speak directly, mm-hmm, with easier access to media. I mean, what John always was interested in was ways to manipulate media. He said, I love advertising. I love television. I love slogans and ways to get messages across to, the masses through the work that I do. That's a paraphrase of a quote. And I think that what he was saying there, that the ways that something like hip-hop just mystified the establishment and the mainstream culture and gave access to these other voices, that always struck me as, you know, something very related to a lot of the stuff that John did. You know, he loved stuff that shook people up. It's why he loved Elvis and early rock and roll. It's why he loved Yoko and the experimental work that she did. And, you know, I think that obviously the ways that music has, you know, what the caller spoke about the sort of corporate commercial culture around so much of pop music, you know, is something that he would have struggled with. But, I think there are things that are out there that that he would have been excited about and that actually relate much more directly to the stuff that he was doing than immediately seems evident.
I mean, Keith, he may have loved advertising the power of a powerful message, but he didn't insult our intelligence. On the contrary, you felt you were in the presence of a real big intelligence with John Lennon.
I agree. Listening to that interview you just played, I thought it was just fabulous. And he did have a way of putting across these messages where you think, hold on, he's got a point. Hold on, he's actually, you know what I mean? You are actually, even if you didn't agree with him, it would produce the emotions where you said, well, I don't agree with that, but you're interested. And I always had a think that if he had been around, I've just always believed that he would have loved the internet. I think he would have absolutely adored the way that he could.
You think he'd be tweeting out there some message to the world?
I do. It's just something I've thought about for many years. You know, how we done the Bedding for Peace, and he was bringing the journalists in, and this was 69, and it was all small scale. It was obviously around. It was a global thing, but it was news reports. Weren't instant. The films had to be sent across the globe. It wasn't quite so instant, but you can imagine if he was around now, he would love the fact that he could send an email to the entire world just like that. You know what I mean? I just think he would actually grasp that modern technology, and I've always believed that.
Maybe the intimacy of it. I mean, we had him curled naked around Yoko Ono, both of them, in doing interviews from bed, and in that same Double Fantasy album, as Alan was saying earlier. Very intimate moments from his life. Here's a Beautiful Boy from the album that came out just weeks before John Lennon's death.
Close your eyes. Have no fear. The monster's gone. He's on the run and your dad is here.
A call from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Cheryl, thanks for calling, Cheryl. You're on the air.
You're welcome. Thank you. I really like the emphasis on both Lennon's artistic legacy and his control of the media, because when we look at him as a personal symbol of peace, I think it's problematic. I'm thinking this because recently I read a book called You Never Give Me Your Money, which examines the legacy of John Lennon and the Beatles more generally after the breakup. And it stands in great contrast to a more hagiographic portrait of Lennon that ran on PBS recently, Lennon Naked, that paints him out to be a sort of peaceful saint. And neither of these interpretations is entirely accurate. He was neither the monster he comes out to be, I think, in You Never Give Me Your Money, but neither is he necessarily a good role model for peaceful behavior in all aspects of his life. And so the emphasis on his legacy as an artist and as a media visionary is healthy, I think, because neither of the other extremes is accurate.
Cheryl, you rock it. Thank you. Keith, what about it there? I mean, even the image of Peacenik has come under some, sharp skepticism lately. And Cheryl there saying, let's be careful on the hagiography. You know, You Never Gave Me Your Money is a pretty tough portrait.
Exactly. When in fact, that's what I said earlier on in the program, where I said if you was to get 100 people in, they would all tell you their different opinion of John. And I really do believe that. You'll have, you know, there's so many interviews where he will say that he wasn't particularly good to women. And then Yoko would say, well, actually he was. So but it was all different all the time. And there was, Lennon wasn't one person. He was made up. I personally think he's made up of loads of different you know, parts, and I do believe that. And what that caller said just then was actually very true, and I do believe that. Lennon wasn't one thing. He was a loads of different parts. That's what I really do believe.
Let's get a call from Beverly, Massachusetts, and John. John, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I've been engaged in a year-long project, a blog about the Beatles. I do a different drawing every week for a year. It's called Happiness is a Warm Pen. And in it, I've come to the conclusion, I used to believe that John Lennon was an inspirational story of a guy who overcame the handicap of losing his mother's love and losing his father's love and never feeling enough to become a worldwide success. But I've come to the conclusion that that's the very reason he was a success. He was a deeply damaged individual. He was broken in a way he could never really be fixed. And for years he spent trying to fill that hole with adulation from crowds. You know, when they were young as Beatles, he used to lead the band in a cheer about, where are we going, fellas? And they'd say, to the toppermost of the poppermost.
Right, right.
And it was Lennon that was the engine of the Beatles. And obviously, they wouldn't have been the huge worldwide success they were without the contributions of McCartney and Harrison, certainly. But it was Lennon that had the hunger and the drive and the nerve to keep going. And this is deeply related to the fact that he was, you know, broken in a way he was never really fixed. And I think he found some happiness in the last 5 years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he went to the top of the mountain, got any worldly success beyond his dreams, and it still wasn't enough. And then he found, I think, that whatever piece he did find was in the relationship with Yoko. And that, even that was fleeting. You know, that came and went. But I look at Lennon, and I look at a lot of people look at it superficially, and it took me 20 years to come to reading the Goldman book. You know, I hated that. It was a character assassination of John. But even a stopped clock is right twice a day.
Yeah.
Goldman had a great insight into Strawberry Fields.
Well,
a lot of people hear Strawberry Fields, and they hear a hippie feel-good anthem.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read between the lines, he's talking about looking out the window of his bedroom at Mimi's house and seeing the orphanage, Strawberry Field, and realizing that there but for the grace of God go he.
Oh, that self-awareness is what you see in the Rolling Stone interview just 3 days before his death. I mean, it really gets incredible. We've got just a little bit more tape from that. I want to play right here, Alan. This is a man who, you know, you should be mature by 40, but he's really mature at 40 in a way many people, I think, maybe never achieve. Here's a little bit more of John Lennon talking with the Rolling Stones' Jonathan Cott. This is 3 days before his death. It's in the apartment there at the Dakota in New York, talking about he'd come over time beyond a simplistic us versus them view of the world to something maybe truer and also more difficult.
So for the few of us who did question what was going on, I have found out personally, not for the whole world, that I'm responsible for it, as well as them. I am part of them. There's no separation. We're all one, right? So in that respect, I think, and I look at it all and think, well, I have to deal with me again in that way. What is real? What is the illusion I'm living? Or am I not living? And deal with it every day, the layers of the onion.
I am part of them, John Lennon saying, just 3 days before his death. A little more music, number 9, Dream. This is from the 1974 solo album, Walls and Bridges. Kind of wistful nostalgia, that dreamscape looking back, and that's years before his untimely death. One more call. Harry, Burlington, Vermont. Harry, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thanks for having me on the air. One of the things I wanted to point out is that Lennon was so smart. You know, he had this just real sublime intelligence and awareness about his world and his surroundings, and it came through not only in his music, but in all those terrific, you know, Dick Cavett interviews over the years, and it's disappointing for me to see that lack of intelligence today in so many of the pop stars. I wondered if you're your callers could speak to that, or your guests could speak to, you know, how smart this guy was.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And how we might yearn for that, Alan. I mean, you hear it in the interview with Jonathan Cutt. I am part of them in all the lyrics. I mean, that kind of intelligence in popular music was such a gift.
Well, and you know, it's nothing that can be replicated. I mean, it's impossible to go back and explain how you could have John Lennon and Paul McCartney, you know, growing up blocks away from each other in this town in England, you know, when nobody had looked to anywhere but America for pop songwriters before, and to go on to hold the absolute central place in the culture of the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the thing, you know, another thing to remember now is things have, you know, entertainment and culture, everything's gotten so big and so diffuse that everybody's kind of interested in their own thing, you know, different kinds of music, different styles, you know, mm-hmm. things on the internet. There's so many places to go. The Beatles were so central to the experience of a culture and a generation, and everybody was paying attention to them. They liked them, they didn't like them, whatever. They had an opinion about them. That sort of platform and that sort of opportunity, you know, that just doesn't, this is not going to come around again. And this was somebody who was, you know, fully up for that. And when presented with a moment or a challenge, would consistently, you know, go beyond that and exceed expectation and go somewhere that you couldn't even anticipate. Well, that's, you know, to compare other things to that is almost ridiculous. It's you're never going to see the stars align in such a way that a figure like that's going to come round again.
And
but
yet,
the
and
remarkable
yet we,
thing is
yeah.
he was up for that. He
right.
could match that.
Yeah, and yet we can long for it. I mean, Keith, it's 30 years now since his death. Do you see this legacy heading into the mist of time, or does it stay? Does it live? Does it go on?
I think it will live on. I really do, because the Beatles music is one of the finest back catalogues. It's possibly the finest back catalogue in pop music. Lennon was such a fascinating fella. Paul, of course, the Beatles story was unique. I don't think we'll ever see anything like it again. And personally, I think, Lennon, yes, I do believe in 10 years' time you'll be inviting us back on your show to talk about Lennon 40 years on. I really do. I think we'll talk about Lennon and the Beatles forever.
All right, let's make a date. I think it'll be worthy. Let's try and do it.
I'll book it in my diary now.
Thanks. Keith Badman in London, author of Beatles Off the Record, Beatles After the Breakup. Thank you so much, Keith.
You're most welcome. Thanks.
And Alan Light at Rolling Stone, it's always wonderful to have you. Thank you for being here today, Alan.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. We remember John Lennon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I hope someday